Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Thursday, May 27, 2021, a bright and sunny day here in Nashville. We had a little rain last night, which has refreshed our garden and the air. As we get started today, I wanted to remind everyone that we've added a new feature to markfraley.com on the webpage. We now have a pop-up which will allow you to enter your email address and thereby receive an email announcement whenever a new program is posted. We will continue to announce new programs on Facebook and Twitter, as we have been doing, but we have found these notices to be unreliable. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and get an immediate notice when a new program is posted. On the Mark Fraley Podcast, we like to shine a light on excellence when it shows its face. Parks and Recreation departments across Tennessee strive to offer a wide variety of programs and services to their communities. Today, citizens are demanding and agencies are providing programs in outdoor recreation, and the study of nature has become a major leisure time activity. Our guest today, Connie Deegan from the Johnson City Parks and Recreation Department, has recently received the prestigious Conservation Educator of the Year Award from the Tennessee Wildlife Federation. This, in recognition of her leadership in offering high-quality programming in that East Tennessee city. I wanted my listeners to get to know Connie and have her tell us in her own words about the cool things she's doing up in Johnson City. And so I hope you'll enjoy today's interview with Connie Deegan. Connie Deegan, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hey, Mark, it's great to be here.
Connie, just to give our listeners the lay of the land, we're doing this meeting, this interview by Zoom video conference. I'm in Nashville and you're in Johnson City, Tennessee.
That's right.
Now tell our viewers or listeners that may not be familiar with the geography of Tennessee exactly where that is.
All righty. Well, Tennessee is a very long state from left to right, and it's got an upper right corner and it's got a lower left corner, where right. That's where Memphis is. So we're probably a good 8 hours apart. And I'm in the northeast corner. I'm about 20 miles away from Virginia and I'm about 20 miles away from North Carolina. It's up in the mountains. It's beautiful.
So you're way, way up in East Tennessee, just adjacent to the Appalachian Mountains.
That's correct. Right now my office sits about 20 miles away from the Appalachian Trail. My house sits about 4 miles away.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Now, Connie, you came on to my attention about 2 months ago, I would guess. I hadn't known you before that time. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing an activity that was posted by the Tennessee Urban Forestry Council that it was happening in Johnson City, and you were pictured in the materials. And so I was intrigued to learn about you, and we've communicated a little bit since then. And most recently, you've gotten really a very prestigious award. The Tennessee Wildlife Federation has pronounced you the Conservation Educator of the Year. And that is a big deal. And congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Now I know why people always stand around and say, I'm really honored, because I am really honored. I really am.
Well, you know, I've lived in Tennessee a long time, and the Tennessee Wildlife Federation used to be known as the Tennessee Conservation League. That's when I was working in conservation. That's what they were called. But they are an organization of very long tenure, and they are serious. They pay attention, and it's a credit to them that they're paying enough attention to what's going on out there in the state to identify you and to highlight you and spotlight on you. So I want to hear, and I want our our listeners to hear about what you're doing up there in Johnson City. You're working for the City of Johnson City Parks and Recreation Department.
That's right. And if I had to describe my job, I work in the capacity of a naturalist, and I really split up my time kind of three ways. I do a lot of public programming for really anybody. My personal motto is never say no. Like, if you can do it, just do it. So I don't care if it's the Boy Scouts or the Country Club Ladies or the Salvation Army or certainly the school system. And there's a lot of people in between that will ask for a program. It might be for a merit badge. It might be for just a group of women that want to get together and learn about, you know, how do I spend time outside? So that's one area where I do some work. And in another area, Johnson City has over 25 parks.
Okay.
And granted, not all parks need the help of a naturalist, but certainly some of them do. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of work in the parks. I help decide where the new trails are going in. I help build the new trails. I might help make decisions on where should we put a parking lot or where's the best location for a brand new outdoor classroom. When the pandemic hit, I was able to re-sign Buffalo Mountain Park. Buffalo Mountain Park is the biggest piece of property that the city owns. It's 725 acres.
Man, that's fantastic.
It is fantastic. It's a great park. It's a great place. And it had been, I don't know, neglected might be too strong a word, but it needed some work. And finally, I was given the okay. And so last summer, I re-signed it, helped make the new map, things like that. And I love the sign system. It should have been in place a while ago. It's up. It's got a QR code that will bring up the map when you use your phone.
Good.
Where you are. And also there's a number on the back of the sign because of the sign of the park. Many people will go into the park and they won't have looked at a map or they won't have enough juice on their phone to pull up the map and they might get lost. And if they get lost or if they get hurt, it usually happens, certainly getting lost us at an intersection. And I can say, go to the sign, look at the back and tell me what the number is. And that number is available to police, EMS, fire, and myself. And then we know exactly where that person is instead of they're in the park.
Very thoughtful. I will tell you that at Radnor Lake State Park here in Nashville, there's a trail that circumscribes the lake. It's about a 3-mile trail. Uh-huh. And there are benches every 800 yards or so as you go around, and they're all numbered just for that very reason, so that if someone has an emergency of some sort and they get on their phone, the ranger can say, well, what number is the bench that you're near? So
that's perfect. So that's the same thing.
So I want to hear a lot more details about some of those things that you're doing. But before we do that, it's kind of traditional in this program for me to inquire about your background, because we like to hear, how did people get to this career in natural resources management, parks and recreation? What in their youth or their upbringing caused that to appear on their dashboard of decision making, and then how did you get here? I mean, tell us that story.
All righty. Well, I'm one of four children. There's two boys and two girls, and I was definitely the outside kid. I was just always outside, and matter of fact, at one point in time, my dad said to me, honey, you're the best boy I have, because I was always the one that always wanted to be out with him when he was doing like dad guy stuff. And so it was, there was just never an option. I didn't really entertain anything else. I just knew I wanted to work in this field. And I really wasn't sure what direction to take it in, because back then you could maybe, I mean, when it came to, when I was very, very young, and I thought of myself in relationship to animals, I knew there was something called a veterinarian, and I knew there was something called a park ranger. And that's really all I knew about. When I got older and I realized that there were different options, I went to school at the University of Rhode Island, and I had a double major. I majored in natural resources and education. And I picked up the education part of my major just because I thought it was a good idea, and it was a great idea. Employers have paid a lot of attention to that part of my degree in the past. And it took a while to settle in. I got out of college. I traveled for 2 years. That was something that I knew I always wanted to do. I wanted to do an offshore sailboat delivery, knock that out. I wanted to live in Ireland, got that done. And then it was time for the real world. And then frankly, things kind of got scary because, you know, when everybody else has confidence in you, but you don't have confidence in you, that's kind of where I was. So I floated around with odd jobs, but then I was given an opportunity to work at a very good nature center. And this was back in Connecticut. And that's really where I got my feet wet. And that was called Denison Pequot Seepos in Mystic, Connecticut. And I did an odd thing. I opted to take a third of a salary cut because I knew that's what I wanted to do. It just didn't matter. And it didn't matter. And so I worked for them. And then I was married. I had a daughter. My husband passed away. I was living in a very expensive state, really, because he was from Connecticut. I wouldn't have picked Connecticut, but there I was. And I was in a very expensive part of an expensive state. And sure, I just said, sure. I said, I'm working as a naturalist. You know, nothing's going to change if I stay here and I keep doing this. So I decided I was going to move. And my daughter, I would have hung in there until she got through high school, but she was interested in moving also. Not because either of us were unhappy, just because that's the kind of people we are. So we both got online and we looked, and I made pretend her vote really mattered, but it didn't matter as much as mine did, of course, because she was only in eighth grade. And I went to a couple of sites, and I found some sites that actually asked me questions regarding, all right, so you want to move. What's important to you? Is nightlife important to you? No. Is outdoor activities important to you? Yes. You know, and I had a list. I had a list that the new place I was going to move to had to meet. I wanted a beautiful place with a lot of outdoor activity. I wanted a university in town in case I wanted to go back to school. I wanted a medical center. It had to be big enough to find employment. And so I picked six places, and my daughter and I went on a road trip. We visited all six. We liked two, Johnson City one, and we moved here. And that was 14 years ago.
Okay, so you moved to Johnson City without a job.
Without a job, without knowing anybody.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
You know, it was cool because 9 out of 10 of my friends would say, you're nuts, you can't do that, you can't take your daughter and go off and do that, blah, 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 blah. And 1 person out of 10 would go, that's awesome. I wish I could do that.
And all the others were just jealous, actually. Yeah.
Perhaps. Yeah, and it was good. It was a good move.
So how did you get linked up with the Parks and Recreation Department?
Well, so I moved here, and that was in that horrible late 2007, 2008, no jobs, mini depression, and I had no connections. So I looked for work. I had a 3-month window that I allowed myself, and man, Mark, I hit it hard. I kept a big file on everything, and I kept names and numbers of who I talked to, but I wasn't getting anywhere in my field. And I knew that. I knew that when I left Connecticut, I knew that I may never get back in my field because I'm not 20. I'm 63 years old. I made that move when I was 50.
Oh boy.
So age discrimination is real. And not that 50 is that ancient, but in my field, sometimes they'll often, I feel, I don't know, not all the time, hire kids out of college and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they'll take the entry positions in the interpretive world. So I ended up getting a job as a contractor with TVA. They let all the contractors go after about a year and a half. I decided I had to remarket myself and perhaps spend the rest of my life working in some field that I didn't really necessarily have the passion for, but it would pay the bills and provide me with insurance for myself and my daughter. And I decided that, well, I'm a programmer. I don't have to be a nature programmer. I mean, who else needs programs? I thought of all these places that needed programmers. And then I saw that the senior center in Johnson City needed someone. And so I took a job there at 10 hours a week, no, 20 hours a week for $10 an hour. That's what it was. And I did that. The job became full-time. After I was there for 2 years, the naturalist left. and I was able to take his place. And that's really
you.
How it happened.
I got you.
And I lucked out.
Well, you know, the city of Johnson City has really a good history of excellence in parks and recreation. They, you know, their programs go back a long, long time.
They do.
And you and I talked briefly on the phone a week or so ago, and I mentioned that I had met a character named Howard Johnson years ago, who was one of the early park and recreation leaders in Johnson City. And Lonnie Lowe was a friend over, was a director there for many years. And as you mentioned, they have some very significant parks, the Buffalo Mountain Park, you know, being the biggest one. But, you know, they have a cadre of community centers and parks and the whole shooting match. So they had a park naturalist there prior to you.
That is correct. He's the only other person that held this position.
Yeah. Now I want to reach back and grab a personal item that you spoke of earlier. And you mentioned that you had lived in Ireland for a time.
I did.
Tell me about that. I'm just fascinated by that.
Oh man, that was awesome. That was, you know, there's been tough times in my life, and maybe there's been times when it's been like better than other times, but overall I have no complaints. But I got to say, Ireland was a great slice. It was a great, great slice. I just became infatuated with Ireland because I'm Irish and I wanted to go to Ireland. And I tried. I'm a big planner. And I tried to get a job before I went. I tried all these different paths and they all ended up in a dead end. So finally I said, I'm just going to go and I'm just going to get off the plane and I'm going to find somebody to give me a job. But remember, before that, I was in the Caribbean and I by chance met a couple. I was working on Anagata in the British Virgin Islands, which nobody's been to except for me. And these people said, the guy said, well, I went to school with this guy and I think he's got a horse farm over there. I'll call him and I will write you a letter. And I knew he meant it and he followed through. So now I had someone's name.
An introduction.
And, great. And so I met him. I went down for an interview to the Bronx, New York, and he hired me on. So I was summer help for him in County Cork on a small island with access to the mainland called Rangiroga. And I worked there as a horse trainer with a man named Seamus O'Reilly, of course.
So you were Seamus O'Reilly, boy, man.
I know. It was great.
Cork,
was like
of course, is way in the south
of
Ireland. And so you were on an offshore island. Wow. So interesting.
Well, we had access to the mainland by bridge, though.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, no ferry. And then that job ended, and I ended up picking apples up in Kilkenny. And I hitchhiked all the time. And I went to 28 out of the 32 counties. And Irish people like Americans. We're not that well-liked every place we go, but Irish people are like, yay. It was just a wonderful experience if you laid out the Caribbean or Ireland, I think many people would pick the Caribbean over Ireland. But I got to tell you, Ireland was 500 times better because of the people. They're just so cool. Yeah.
My wife and I were there 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago. And we spent the majority of our time in Cavan, which is in the north.
Uh-huh.
And a pretty, pretty solid equestrian center there. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but it's, but as you say, the people are welcoming and they all have a cousin that lives in the States.
They do. And they want to know if you know him.
And they, yes, everybody wants to know if you know him. All right. We don't need to talk about Ireland. That's not why we're here, but I was so curious. All right. So you got hired. And how long have you been there in Johnson City? I mean, in that particular job?
I think in this job, I believe this is my eighth year.
All right.
With the city, it's been 10 years. Because I had that short couple of years at the senior center.
You clearly have the support of leadership in that department.
I do. Like any position, you know, there's always a short list of, gee, I wish things could go in that direction instead of this direction. But it's a pretty sound operation.
Tell us more about that. You know, you are the one that's trained in natural resources. You mentioned that you were interacting with the maintenance people and the developmental people in your department. Tell us how you manage those connections.
Well, you know, it's an odd position for the city, I feel, because I'm pretty familiar with many positions because I've been here, but I've got a bit of freedom. And I love that. So my job is very varied. So there's a lot of trust there because I'm not findable, if you will, at every moment of the day. And no one, and there's a disadvantage to this and there's an incredible advantage to this, but I don't work with another naturalist. I don't have someone above me saying, I need you to go out and cut this trail. I need you to go. Nobody tells me what to do. I decide what the priorities are based on opportunities that are available to the parks, and I pick and choose. And so I put stuff in place to make things happen.
Fantastic.
And they trust me. And they trust me also, and this is not a slight at all, but they don't do what I do. You know, they don't really do what I do. So they're like, oh, a tree arboretum? Is that cool? I don't know. And I'm like, that's really cool.
Yes, and that's one of the projects that you've been working on lately. Talk about it. What's happening with your arboretum?
Well, the arboretum, we got a park started to happen about 10 years ago, and it's a small park. It's 28 acres, and it's very diverse because it's got habitat, it's got meadow, it's got wetland, and it's got hardwood forest. So there's quite a variety of wildlife and plant life in that small space. So it already had 30 species of trees in there just sitting and waiting to be made into an arboretum. It was a matter of signage and paperwork. So one really neat volunteer took that on with his church group, and we worked together, and that arboretum happened. And then a situation happened where there was a $1,000 donation from AT&T Pioneers, which is their volunteer organization. And the man that they approached just couldn't do, it just wasn't a good fit for him at that time. So he said, do you have any interest? And I'm like, heck yeah. So with an awesome, I have incredible volunteers. I have incredible volunteers that I work with. And one of the women, Melanie Kelly, was like, all right, let's do it. Let's bump this up to a level two. Let's use it at Jacobs. And actually it was specific to trees. So it fit perfectly. So all of our trees are native. We have a lot of wetland species, which makes it different. And the fact that it's native makes it different. And now, well, I can't say today it's a 60 tree arboretum, but we have about 70 different species now planted in that park. All the trees we got from Overhill Nursery south of Knoxville are doing fine, but I'm going to wait until they get a little size to them before I sign them.
And you mentioned that you're choosing to use native trees.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I am a kind of a plant native Nazi.
Well, I guess we share that conviction. Yeah. But tell the listeners about that. There are lots of choices in trees.
There are. Well, I'll tell you what, let me give an example that I think most people can get. There was a study that was done at the University of Ohio, and they monitored pairs of cardinals, and birds use cues regarding when it's time to start a family. So we have one invasive that's all the heck over the place up here. I'm sure it's all over where you are. It's called bush honeysuckle.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And it misplaces a lot of our redbuds and dogwoods and other small trees or shrubs. It's very aggressive. And so it leaves out earlier than our other native species. So birds look around and they go, hey, look at that. Springtime. Leaves are coming out. We'll make a nest. We'll start a family. So they do. And so a raccoon comes along and he sees all this activity of cardinals flying back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And he walks around the corner and says, all right, so I see a bush with no leaves, a bush with no leaves, a bush with leaves, a bush with no leaves. I bet you $50 they've got a nest in the bush with leaves. So the babies and or the eggs are eaten more often if they nest in that particular shrub, that invasive. And then it gets worse because in the fall, that shrub has red berries. And female cardinals, one of the criteria they use for selecting a mate is how red the bird is, the male is. If he's very, very red, it shows them that, hey, this guy's really competed successfully for a whole lot of food. So genetically, he's going to be great. he's going to be a good dad guy because he's going to be able to help me feed these little guys. So he's the guy. And unfortunately, the red berries pass on the red pigment, but they are not the correct combination of digestibility, protein, carbohydrates that the birds need. So they eat them and you think all is good, but over time, the generation after generation after generation, the birds are just not doing, they're not as robust as they were
thriving,
20
right.
years ago.
Right.
So
right.
that's why, that's that particular invasive story, but there's tons of them. You know, things evolve together and our native animals anticipate native foods. If I gave you two packs of ramen and a yogurt to eat every day, you know what? You'd be alive, but you wouldn't be doing a heck of a lot.
Very good.
But you'd be alive.
So,
go ahead. Sorry.
In laying out the parameters of the programming that you do as a naturalist in the parks there in Johnson City, that is an example of a theme or a theory that you're not a theory. It's a theme that you're using as a template to do programming. You know, the invasive exotics versus natives and the pluses and minuses. How do you think about other themes in your programming?
Well, you know, some of it's kind of, I get requests, specific requests from people. So that helps. If I get the same request, you know, half a dozen times, and even if, I shouldn't say this, but even if I don't want to do it, I do it because there's an interest in it. I try to really cover the gamut. For example, many naturalists we like to think that we know a little bit about a whole lot of stuff because we have to.
Right.
But we tend to specialize in one or two areas. And I am actually a herpetologist. And of all the little herps, I'm a snake person. Ever since I was a little kid, it's been all about snakes for me. So I do a lot of reptile and amphibian programs because that's where my strengths are. But some parks, now if I've got a 30-tree arboretum in Jacobs Nature Park at Sinking Creek, well, guess what? I'm going to just turn that into a program. I'm going to turn that into a tree identification program, but it's not going to be a boring tree identification program. I'm not going to talk about, it's got opposite leaves, and here's what the male flower looks like, and here's what I'm going to tell a really cool story about that tree so people remember it, and they'll go, right. Oh, I recognize that because of that flower, because that's where the blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So I kind of do what I want, but I look around with what's available to me, and that helps me out.
Yeah, I noticed that the Parks and Recreation Department in Johnson City has a Facebook page of their own, and you are frequently doing little video vignettes on that Facebook page. Most recently, I saw one about the myth of the praying mantis.
Yes.
And it was so fascinating because I had heard that myth before and I'd never had anybody debunk it. So tell us about that.
Oh, thanks. You know, that's been really fun for me. It's actually a lot of work because I'm not a writer. So that little paragraph might take me 3 hours to write. Nobody knows that.
So interesting that you would say that because it looks looks extemporaneous. So there you go.
Awesome.
You go. Yeah.
So I picked different themes and this is kind of my fourth one. And this one is on animal myths. And there's a ton of myths that we've all heard our whole lives. Like, I think my opening one was lemmings jump off cliffs. When there's too many lemmings, they commit suicide and they jump off cliffs. So I investigate and try to find out, where did that start? Is it true? How did this come to be? And that's a really interesting story. Or do camels really carry water in their humps? Or, you know, praying mantises, can you get fined if you step on a praying mantis? Is it illegal to hurt a praying mantis? Because I've always heard that when I was a kid too. And there's never been anything on the books about that. It's just something that picked up speed because people, as bugs go, people don't like bugs, but people are extremely tolerant of certain bugs, butterflies, obviously. And praying mantises are somewhat in the good,
sure.
the good bug
ladybugs, right.
So So there's no specific start to that. There's only a timeline. It's kind of sort of showed up in the 50s, and gardeners kind of jumped on that, and it picked up speed, and everybody just, well, you know, you can't hurt a praying mantis because they'll find you.
Well, and then there's the part about them killing hummingbirds.
Oh, yeah.
Where did that come from?
I hate that. I really hate that because, you know what? I have to be honest. In Northeast Tennessee, we have three praying mantises. And our native praying mantis is the Carolina mantis. And he's smaller than the other two invasive mantises. And they are bigger. And they can take bigger prey. And every once in a while, you will find a very graphic picture of a big praying mantis that managed to grab a hummingbird or a tiny snake.
Okay.
Now, wow. It happens, but it's extremely rare. And so People will take that and run with it. And then everybody's walking around just destroying praying mantises. So
I noticed the other day that you posted a video about ragweed and goldenrod and the effect on allergies. So interesting.
Oh, thanks.
So, when you have classes with people, do you go through these things? Are people interested in hearing those kind of things?
Yeah, that actually, I took that series, which I call Naturally Yours. That comes out weekly on Wednesdays. And originally, the first two-year one was just going outside in the parks and finding something in a park. So it's done in real time. Like, this is what I found today, and it happens to be October 31st. So we know that this plant is blooming now, or this whatever. And then I wrote about it. And people like those little tiny snippets because I pick stuff that I think is more interesting than stuff that isn't.
Right.
And I stopped after 2 years because I could have gone on until I died. But when you're dealing with the general public, I might think tree bark is really exciting, but I don't know if I could get away with tree bark.
Exactly. Now, do you have a facility that is kind of like your home base there, a nature center type facility or a place where you do mainly your business?
You know, I don't. I do not have a nature center. There's talk about it. It kind of comes and goes. And of course, that's dependent upon the budget. And I don't know when that will happen. I do think it will happen. But I just have a little beanie office. And I do most of my work outside of my office.
Sure.
I do have a couple of outdoor classrooms that I'll utilize. Like sometimes I'll take a whole fourth grade field trip from one of the elementary schools. And they'll come and meet in an outdoor classroom. And we have a program, and then we just go take a hike. And,
got you.
But no, I don't.
So Connie, have you had an opportunity to interact with others that are doing similar work to you around the state of Tennessee?
Oh, that's a great question. This is what's really cool about naturalists. I guess I can't speak for everybody, but I bet I would be surprised if it wasn't true. Remember, we're all kind of good at different things. And, so I might ask Larry to come help me do an owl program because he can call in owls like anybody. I mean, he's just awesome. But, and he might ask me to help him with his summer festival doing a snake talk. So we'll share each other in the community. Sometimes Marty Silver and I will do things back and forth, or I do things up at Rome Mountain State Park, and they come here, and I have a speaker every day in my nature camps, and I get awesome speakers, and I don't pay them anything.
Yeah, Marty Silver that you mentioned is the park naturalist at Warrior's Path. And
that's right.
Has been there, I guess, approaching 40 years at this point.
Yeah, since he was about 2 inches tall. Yeah.
Well, he's a terrific guy.
Yes.
I remember working with him. And Jennifer Bauer, was a naturalist at Roan Mountain for so many years, as now it's at Sycamore Shoals in Elizabethan.
Right. Jennifer and I finally met each other on Facebook, but we have yet to meet each other, which seems so odd to me, but we will.
Well, you really should take the time. She's just a terrific person. And I mean, I first met Jennifer, I guess 1982 or 83. And she had just published her first book at that point. I mean,
cool.
And she was very, you know, we were both very young at that stage,
uh-huh.
So we, you know, we do have nature study, nature centers in Memphis. Nashville has a couple, Chattanooga, they're around Clarksville.
They all have programs. Yeah, and there's some in the Tri-Cities as well. There's Steel Creek Park in up in Bristol, and then right. there's Big Mountain in Kingsport.
Exactly. And
perhaps that is why that Johnson City doesn't feel the urgency to like jump into that, because we are. But you know, it would be different from theirs. I would like to think it would be different from theirs. I would like it to be much more of a small building without tons of stuff in cages, and much more about now let's go outside and find stuff. Terrific. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
Less of a zoo and more of a, not that I'm not trying to make a negative comment at all. I'm just saying that's what I would like to see.
I understand. Now in your role there, interacting with other folks in your agency, thinking about when a new park is built, do you have an opportunity to sit down with the landscape architect or the architect to talk about specifying plants that and bushes and that sort of thing that
you know
are incorporated?
I wish I did. Sometimes I'll be very involved in a small piece of it. Like, we're going to build this new park and we would like you to be responsible for this pollinator garden. But we do have a city forester.
Okay. So I didn't realize that.
Fields,
okay.
Yes. He fields much of that.
Okay.
And he's moving in the direction of natives. And there you go.
So important.
It is.
Now, I know that you are in the process right now of preparing for your summer programs.
Right.
Tell us about what you're doing in the summer, the history of it, and you know, kind of what you do.
All righty. Well, it's almost summer camp time, and I have six different camps. I have five of them for little kids, 7 to 12 years of age, and then I have a teen camp. I have a different theme each week, and as mentioned, I have a speaker each day, and I do that because I feel no matter how good you are in your field, kids just don't want to listen to you every single day, you know?
Yes.
So I've worked towards that, and people are so wonderfully giving with their time. So I might have a camp. They all have different themes. So let's say I have a wilderness survival camp. This year, wilderness survival and geology filled up quicker than my other camps. And wilderness survival is going to cover age-appropriate topics like the 10 essentials. And we're going to talk about how important it is. Like, basically, wilderness survival is all about your brain. It's a mindset. It's like, wow, this happened, and I got to not panic, and I got to keep my act together, and here's what I got to do. And then there's things on water and water purification. There's things on food. There's things on shelter building, appropriate fire starting methods, things like that for this age group. It's always a big hit. We do a lot of hiking. And then another camp that I have, of course, we have to have a reptile and amphibian camp.
There you go.
And each of them on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we always take a field trip. So we'll have a lesson, and then we'll go, if we talk about salamanders, we might go to Buffalo Mountain Park. And you can really never say this as a naturalist, but I can say this. We will find salamanders in that creek. So it's really cool to be able to talk about an animal and then hand out these clean, giant Skippy peanut butter jars. And go out after instructing kids how to handle the animals and clean their hands first with the dirt at the bottom of the stream, and see what we can catch. And then we ID everything at the end, and of course we release them. And there's crayfish and there's aquatic insects, so it's a great learning opportunity. Camp is fun.
So the camps will last throughout the summer.
They'll last, yeah. And summer is, of course, I'm used to the New England schedule, but so to me they're short. Camps are all of June and much of July.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, in these camps, I'm just curious, is there a fee to attend and participate in these? And
there is, And I'll tell you, you know, I modeled these camps after our camps in Connecticut. And okay. I don't remember the price of our camps in Connecticut, but I know it was like $350, okay. I think. Now, this is Parks and Rec, so we don't have $350 camps. But for $80, you get your little t-shirt and your water bottle. You are with adults all day long. You go on at least 2 field trips. You go swimming at least once. You will learn something every day. You will make new friends. You will exercise. And my camps are outside all day long, yeah. all the time. And they go home tired. So that's so it's
and you'll have a lunch. You'll have a lunch in the
have a lunch. And actually breakfast and lunch are supplied by the school system.
Sure.
Which is wonderful.
Right.
And so yeah, for $80, that's for 1 week. And I don't even remember what that breaks down to per hour. But it's like, you know.
Well, you can't beat that.
Yeah. It's 35 hours of camp for like $1.88 an hour.
That takes a lot of planning to
that
do.
That takes a lot of planning. It does.
Yeah. And you're already doing the planning for July at this point.
Oh, it's done.
Yeah.
It's done. It's been done for a long time. Yeah. Because there's so many different pieces and parts, You know, you have to get your CPR and first aid, and you have to get your lifeguard cert re-upped, and you have to get the bus ready, and you have to get all the copies, and you have to get all the presenters, and you have to get the food lined up, and you have to
the
get
supplies
the
t-shirt ordered, and you have to think of the themes.
Yeah. So I'm glad I've done this a few times before because it's just a little bit easier now.
Now, do you have staff that assists you in that?
I am able to hire 2 summer counselors.
Okay.
And I can't say, and this is no surprise either. We don't pay a ton because we're city government, and it's a temporary position. But what the counselors get is, I generally will get a counselor from the Parks and Rec department at ETSU, so they're going to get really good experience in how to run a day camp. They're going to learn about themselves, about children, about nature. And they also, I always ask them, please talk to your professor and see if you can't get a practicum or an internship done at the same time while you're working here.
So they get some credit for it.
Yeah, so they get a double bang for the buck, and that makes me and probably them feel a lot better.
And so this is the Parks and Recreation Administration curriculum there at ETSU.
That is correct.
Right.
I'm an adjunct there, so I have contact with the students.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I know that you have an active part in the university. Tell us about that.
Well, I was extremely flattered, and I did do some partnership stuff with the Parks and Rec guys over at ETSU. And at one point, they needed an instructor, and they asked me, and I never saw that coming. And I was like, really? And so I decided it would be cool, and I decided I'd learn some. And so I did it, and it was really fun. So I teach 2 different classes only in the spring semester, and they rotate every other year I teach them. And one is called Camp Leadership, and one is called, and we have a real live camp with real live little humans when they're on spring break. And then there's one called ROLS, which is Regional Outdoor Leadership Services, which has been on the books for a long time, and I've got a lot of leeway in that. We basically pick an agency, which is me, to work for, and I have the students help me do stuff that I need done. So it's about, this is what you would anticipate if you worked at a Parks and Rec for city government, if that's what you would like to do. And, you know, that's really how I get stuff done, is I manage small groups of people, because I'm the only person that does this in the city.
Right.
So I get students and volunteers and service fraternities and high school kids, and I'm organized, man. If somebody says I want to do something, I'm like, I got an idea. I got the tools. Let's put it on a calendar.
Just fantastic. Connie, it's just been a joy to speak with you today, to learn about what you're doing up there. Wish you the best of luck as things develop, and I hope you'll stay in touch. And I hope our listeners will dial up the Facebook page of the Johnson City Parks and Recreation Agency and check you out, just the things that you've got going on, because they'll learn something. And that's the key.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I'm so flattered that you tracked me down, and you are extremely easy to talk to. I'm very grateful for that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Enjoyed having you. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, you take care. Okay. Bye.